from the world of writing who has a lot of messages for us. Her name is Carolyn Howard Johnson. She's an expert on all types of writing. She's done it. She's written books. She's written fiction. She's written nonfiction. She's guided authors. And she is an experienced presenter at colleges like the University of California Extension School and the Writers Bureau. She's the author of two books that have a lot of lessons for us, both in what they contain and also in what they reflect, because she, like most successful authors, has branded herself in a beautiful way, in a way that doesn't need to be explained. The titles of her book, and the two books that we're going to be talking about, one is, and the more recent one is, The Frugal Editor. The Frugal Editor. Put your best foot forward to avoid humiliation and ensure success. And she began this brand with a previous book, which, you know, not only reflects an excellent brand, but an excellent subtitle, an excellent pairing of a metaphoric word with a subtitle that explains the whole story. And that book is The Frugal Book Promoter, How to Do What Your Publisher Won't. She's written other books on book proposal writing, The Complete Writer's Journal. She was a co-author of that. Her website is carolynhoward-johnson.com, and there's just dozens of free resources. And what I would call an excellent example of a media kit. Later on in the call, we'll return to this, but I think her example of a media kit that you can download is really great. The relevance is this. Money is tight everywhere in the publishing cycle. Author, publishers, and retailers, especially this year, are really interested in maximizing things and in putting duties onto others. And the origins of the frugal brand, which is such a wonderful word, isn't it, frugal, because it doesn't imply cheap. It implies frugality, implies all of the right things and none of the others. So the other message and her relevance is that everything we write is a marketing expression of this, of us. We need to be error-free, not only in our manuscript, but while planning, writing, promoting, and profiting from our books in all aspects. So welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. Glad you could come. Let's start at the beginning. Were you a reader while growing up?
Oh, absolutely. I can remember I actually used my reading to avoid washing dishes with my mother. If I was reading, she actually believed that I couldn't hear her when she called me.
Oh, geez.
She said I had convenient hearing when I was reading.
Well, what kind of books were you reading?
Oh, I read everything. I can remember reading a book about Johnny Microbe. The Secret Garden was one of my favorites, and one of the ones I always tell my tutoring students about. And little girls are still reading that. I read Nancy Drew. I think probably, I don't know, there probably was 50 of them now, and there are probably several hundred of them. There were probably several hundred of them then. So. I just read. I went to the library, and sometimes I'd take out six books and finish them all before I got home.
Wow.
I'd stop along the way and take one out of my basket and read it under a tree.
Where was this? Where were you brought up?
Well, I was brought up in a very small town in Utah called Springville. It was a town of about 4,000 then. It was very nice, mm-hmm. very nice way to grow up, because you kids could wander around town, ride their bikes to the library. Kids are much more protected today, at least in the big cities.
Yeah. So, when did you first become interested in becoming actively involved in publishing, or the other side of the cover, becoming involved in doing more than just reading?
Well, I got interested in boys at about age 16, and all the cute boys were on the journalism staff in high school. So I decided I would go out for the school newspaper. So that sort of pushed me into writing, and then I realized that I adored it. So, and I thought about my first novel, This Is the Place, when I was about 18. I wanted to write Gone with the Wind, excepting set in Utah, because there were already too many novels set in the South and nothing set in Utah, and I thought that was pretty chintzy. So, but I didn't get around to writing it until several decades long later. It obviously was quite a long gestation period. Sometimes we put things off that we're passionate about, thinking that we'll do it later or making excuses for not doing it. And I'm one who doesn't believe that's particularly good for your mental health.
Mm.
But that's what I did, so I speak from experience.
Ah, that's wonderful. So, and did you, college, how did this have a role? You're finally writing the book. Was this after college?
I studied journalism in college and got a job very, very early on the Salt Lake Tribune. My husband and I traveled to New York, and I worked for Good Housekeeping magazine as an editorial assistant. And I also had a job there with Eleanor Lambert. She was very famous in her day for fashion publicity. So I wrote media releases. We called them press releases then for her. I adored journalism. But this was a long time ago, and women in those days had a different idea about what their role in society was. And their role in society, first and foremost, was as a wife and mother. And I was convinced by my culture, basically, that although I loved writing and wanted to write and had that novel in my head, that basically everyone else and everything else should come first. So I stopped writing mostly. I did a little bit here and there, and raised two beautiful children. And my husband and I opened businesses. You mentioned retailing, as a matter of fact. We started a small chain of stores, and we did that for 30 years. And then I got sick, and I realized that if I didn't write that novel, I might never get a chance to do it. So I did it, and I was nearly 60 when I started.
Huh. You mentioned a coach. You had a coach back then? A writing coach, or
I was a journalism major in school, and then I moved from that into education and English lit. I believe in coaches. I believe in consulting and having people help you with projects that are new to you. I'd have probably done better when I moved into publishing if I had hired a coach. Unfortunately, I didn't know what I didn't know. And I think that's often true when we start something new. We assume that our background is going to help cover that for us, and it certainly contributes, but we're often completely unaware of the stuff that we don't know. As an example, it's very difficult if you're a writer, to move from one genre to another. And writers assume they can write that. So if they've been writing all their lives, theme papers, in school or writing for business, they assume that they can write a novel. And that just isn't true. There's just so much more to learn. And then we do the same thing when we move from a novel to short stories. Lots to learn. And then I moved to poetry and more stuff still to learn. So the only place my journalism experience really helped me a lot was with my nonfiction, the two books that you mentioned. So I believe coaches can make a big difference. If you know an hour spent with a coach, who at least can give you and put you on the right path and give you an idea of what you need to learn from there, can be a huge advantage.
Is this an hour a month, an hour a week, or what?
Well, you know, I think it depends on the situation, don't you? You do coaching. I saw your little shirt with coach on the front. So I'm sure you advise your clients, depending on what their situation is, how much they need. And when I consult, I don't call myself exactly a coach, although I think I am kind of a cheerleader. When I consult, I try to get as much as I can in that first consulting period with my writer, with my author. And then we move from there. Sometimes they have me back, And sometimes with a lot of pre-preparation, we can pretty much do what they need to have covered in just an hour or an hour and a half. Other times we do it periodically, as you say, once a week to kind of... Some people need more nudging than others, don't you think?
Oh, very definitely.
Some people need that every week.
Including some coaches.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Well, I'd like to know more about the origins of the Frugal brand and where these two delightful books came from and why you chose to use the title The Frugal Editor or The Frugal Book Promoter rather than anything than a simpler, more straightforward thing. What are the pros and cons of, and how was the Frugal brand, where did it come from? Let's start. What was this, a brainstorm? Were you driving a tractor trailer truck and suddenly frugal book promoter?
The actual title probably sprang from something that happened to me in the process of writing my novel, but I've always been frugal, and I broke that rule when my novel This Is the Place was published. It needed to be published before the Olympics in Utah, because it's set in Utah, and I, you know, I wanted to do the promotion for it and have it out there, and I knew that would help sales, having had some publicity background. But I was also laboring under one of those things I didn't know. I was also laboring under the idea that publishing was still pretty much the way it had been when I was interested in writing back in the early 60s. And that was that you got a traditional publisher and that you wrote the book and that the publisher did everything else. Well, surprise, that's not what happened. And I had a lovely maiden aunt who had died, and she left me $35,000. And I broke my frugal rule, the part of me that is frugal, and decided that she wouldn't mind if I spent that money that she left me on something that I was passionate about. So I knew I needed help with promotion because I didn't, although I had had fashion publicity background, I certainly didn't know anything about book publicity. Again, two different things, similar but different. And I spent a lot of money. It turned out I didn't spend quite the full $35,000, but almost, on a publicist. And that publicist didn't do one thing for me that I couldn't do for myself. Mm. And so the Frugal brand was born out of the way I am, and you're right, that doesn't mean cheap, it doesn't mean skimp. There are certain things that you need to pay for, but certainly there's a lot, and usually it's publicity versus advertising that you can do to publicize your book, and it's usually more effective than paid advertising. And I wanted to pass all those secrets that I learned the hard way once I dropped my publicist and started learning it on my own to other authors, because I just kept hearing over and over again other authors making the same mistake, if not spending that much money, not understanding that they were going to have to promote their book. They were published by big publishers, and the book was allowed to die. And they didn't know until really it was basically too late, although I say it's never too late now, to jump in and do something about it. So the Frugal Book Promoter came about that way.
How about the subtitle, How to Do What Your Publisher Won't?
Well, I think that was born of a little bit of anger. I was really angry at publishers. I'm not as angry anymore. In fact, a lot of publishers actually use that book now to give to their new clients, their new authors, so that they have some idea of how they should at least partner with them, with the publisher. So that they'll have some idea that they need to work with them and do a lot of work on their own. But at that time, I was pretty ticked off with my publisher. So I knew that publishers, for the most part, including the big ones, including the ones that we all hope that we'll be published by, just don't have the budgets anymore for promoting that they once did. And that doesn't mean that they don't promote Stephen King, but, you know, he doesn't need the promotion so much. But the midline authors, the new authors, rarely get very much promotion. So
I don't understand the term midline. I can understand top line would be Stephen King, but midline, and what's the next one below midline?
Well, they actually don't even include one below middle author, and that's not quite the term. It's evading me right now.
Okay.
But basically, it's their emerging authors, the new ones that they bring on. And it seems really backward to me, because it seems that if you're bringing a new author into your publishing firm, that for heaven's sakes, you should be, you're doing that to feed new talent into your firm. So the least you can do is really give them a leg up. But that's not really necessarily how it happens. I have many personal friends who were published by the biggest and best names and were sorely disappointed. So I know... Not firsthand. I've never been published by a huge publisher, but I know pretty firsthand that does happen.
Hmm. Who is Red Engine Press?
Oh, Red Engine Press is the sponsor for the organization that I founded. It's called Authors Coalition, and the website for that is Authors Coalition and RedEnginePress.com. And they sponsor that website and that organization. And so I'm the founder, and they're the sponsor, and they do most of the day-to-day book work, et cetera. And they also published my second book, The Frugal Editor, and they're a traditional press.
Hmm.
But it's not a small one.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the small ones they're small. They don't have a lot of money for promotions.
Mm-hmm.
So traditional, or whether you self-publish or whether you subsidy publish, which means basically that you hire, in a sense, a coach to help you through the publishing process, no matter how you publish, you are going to need to know how to promote. And, of course, editing is part of that process.
So what, after the success of your Frugal book promoter, what was the instigation for writing The Frugal Editor?
Well, at one point I realized that people, once they were published, didn't really understand how editing fit into that process. So many more people are self-publishing today, and so many more people are using subsidy publishers. And then I also realized that there were a whole lot of people, again, who were published by big publishers, traditional publishers, who expected to get an editor like, remember the days of Jacqueline and Onassis, where she would take your book and she was the editor and she would shepherd your book lovingly through the process and make sure it got promoted and make sure it got beautiful editing and help you with your structure. And people were always very grateful for having a great editor. Well, It seems anymore that those are almost non-existent. And anybody who submits a book anymore without having edited it thoroughly, preferably in partnership with a real editor, is doing their book a disservice. So I became as passionate about that as I was about promoting. And in that process, I realized that good editing is, in fact, good marketing. That if we put on a poor impression in front of people because something's been poorly edited, whether it's a query letter or whether it's a full manuscript, then we're not marketing very well. And in the process of actually having that book edited by the best editor I could find with 30 years' experience in university presses, her name is Trudy McMurrin. And I am crazy about my editor, and she's the only real editor I've ever had. I've had other editors who I consider more typo hunters, but certainly not full complete service editors.
Mm-hmm.
I found it a learning experience. It cost me almost $1,800 to do that before I even submitted it to Red Engine Press, and that's a lot of money for it. For a starving author to put out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, I figured it was like taking three classes at UCLA, which would cost about $395 each or something, and plus I got my editing from it. So even though I was already considered myself an editor, I learned something from this editor. We never stopped learning. And she was just fantastic. So she added a lot to that book. And then my husband added a lot, too. I handed it over to him kind of last, kind of as an afterthought. And it was done. It was done. I just wanted him to check for typos and see if he could find any last grammatical changes, etc. And he said, you need to have something in here on query letters. Well, I was kind of recalcitrant. It was done. I was really ready to move on. I don't want to do it. And the next day in my email, I started getting letters back from agents who were just happy to contribute their pet peeves that they found in query letters to me. And my husband had sent out a very nice query of his own asking them to give me input on my book. So there I was with something like 100 answers from 100 of our nation's top editors, all agents, all eager to help authors do better with their query letters. Mm. So what could I do but add a couple chapters?
Exactly.
And it turned out that those are, I think, two of the most valuable chapters in the book.
Well, you're bringing up an interesting point that the difference between editing and proofing.
It's huge. It's huge. And most people just don't realize it. And so what's happening is there are a lot of people who have published a couple books, self-published a couple books. You know, they got A's in English. Maybe a lot of teachers are doing it. You know, they've taught in their past. They taught English, maybe at even the college level. That makes them really good, probably, at spelling errors, typo errors, but they don't know anything about formatting. They don't know anything about front matter or back matter or indexing. They don't know anything about fiction structure unless they've written a book. And sometimes even if they've written a novel, they don't know very much about the structure of a novel. So there are just so many things to know. Dialogue tags and it goes on and on. And those even are punctuated differently in some instances than a good English teacher would expect them to be punctuated. So you can see that a really good editor is worth the money, and that because you know English really well doesn't make you an editor.
But what as a digression from our what I had planned to ask, but I think it's just a wonderful opportunity, is you're saying that some people who've gotten A's in English are now writing, and that you pointed out, the ability to write grammatically correct is not the ability to have a seamless book. But what about people who have a message, who know their topic, who know their market, who have a definite bundle of information that is needed by a reachable market, but they got C's in English or worse? Does this mean they can't write a book?
Nope, it absolutely does not mean that. All you need is a great editor. You might need a ghostwriter too, depending, but absolutely not. You have at it. In fact, sometimes those people write, if they can forget that they think that they're supposed to write like a textbook, if they can forget that and they just write the way they talk, they can write with more passion and it's more readable than if they dropped back into, you know, that kind of business-ese type letter that a lot of people do when they're writing a business letter. And then a good editor can just clean it up for them.
But that's such a psychological thing. I mean, I think that so many people have had their writing ability stifled by Miss Christie in the fourth grade. Now, I won't say that she's from Easton, Connecticut, where I live, coincidentally. But, you know, I think that there's so many wonderful people out there with so many great ideas that
absolutely
can't diagram a sentence, or worse, couldn't diagram a sentence and feel they can't write.
So go for it. Go for it. There's all kinds of help. The thing about it is that publishing is so wide open now that you're not at the mercy of anyone anymore. You can be experimental. You can write a book a book that no big publisher would ever publish because the market's so tiny. It's called Niche Marketing now, but there's still a market for it because we have the internet. So if you've got a book inside you, you have control over your own writing career now. The only thing I would caution you is to make sure before it's published that it's professional. And you can get help with that. You can get lots of help with that. So just start. Outline that book the way you would a paper and dig in. And a good editor, if she says, you know, this sounds like a textbook, do you want to market it as a textbook, or do you want it to be a popular book to reach other markets? And you say, I want it to be a popular book to reach other markets. Let her help you find your voice. Let her help you write like you talk. Get it out there. Get it on paper.
I want to emphasize, and I've been underlining mentally as you've been talking, three times you've mentioned sound. Sounds like a textbook. Find your voice. You're not talking words on paper. You're talking the sound of words and the impact of them, and that's and the passion that drives a good book.
Yeah, you know, when people read, they hear it in their brain. They're not reading words. They're reading and thinking, and they're putting that together like a puzzle. They're imagining, probably in Technicolor, what you're saying on paper. And I guess that's a sort of sound too. So when we write, that's what we're after. Even if we're writing a straight textbook, which sounds serious and scary, and most people are through with textbooks when they're out of school, they've had enough of those. Well, you can still write serious subjects and include anecdote and include dialogue so that those subjects come alive. They don't have to be dull.
One of my favorite authors is Malcolm Gladwell. He writes for The New Yorker, and he wrote that Blink is his latest book, nonfiction book. And I was reading at the time, I tend to read two or three books at once, you know, by the bed. And I was reading an Ed McBain mystery. You know, he wrote the 47th Precinct series over a period of probably 40 years of these wonderful New York police procedurals. And I love his writing. I love it. I love it. I love it. But I put it down to read a book about how the mind processes information, because that was more exciting, that Malcolm Gladwell had created with Blink a more compelling read than a mystery. I mean, that's why I think that he is just such a powerful individual, and
that could have been very dry. I mean, it could have read like a psychology textbook that you took you had to buy in your freshman year in college, but it didn't sound like that. It didn't read like that, and the reason it didn't is because he writes for The New Yorker, for gosh sakes, and he knows how to use elements of fiction in his writing. So he tells stories to illustrate his points. And that's what we're really after. People love stories. You asked me what inspired me. I think one of the things that inspired me was my mother, who is no writer. She's an oral storyteller. And she tells stories. She tells stories about my father's heritage. She tells stories about her grandparents. She tells family stories. In fact, my second book is called Hearkening, and it's a book of what is called creative nonfiction. And that means that they're written like stories with dialogue and setting. They read like short stories, like fiction, but they're really true. And those are true stories told by my mother to me. So obviously influenced by storytelling. And, of course, oral tradition goes back to Homer and before. So that oral tradition is really important. And if we can make our writing sound like we're telling stories, then we catch a reader. And it doesn't make any difference how it's published. It'll be a great book if it tells stories and if it's edited well, so that you don't take your reader out of that story with gaping errors.
Gapping, gaping errors, I suspect is a segue back to the era, back to the topic of the frugal editor, and I do want to talk about how the frugal editor interacts with the four stages of writing a book: planning, writing, promoting, and profiting. However, I think you have hinted at something that I want your opinion on, is that the issue, again, we talked about I'm not a writer as a reason not to write a book. And the second reason is I'm not qualified, or I'm not a researcher, or I'm not I don't have a PhD in the topic that I want to write about. Can you address that?
You know, that reminds me of a story. See, storyteller. My first book, This is the Place, I was at Vroman's, which is an independent bookstore in Pasadena near where I live. And I was speaking to an audience at my book launch. And there was a man in the audience, and he raised his hand and he said, "Do you have a PhD?" And I said, "No, I didn't." And he said, "Well, I've been coming to these author events at Vroman's, and it seems to me that most people who write books have a PhD. And I'm here to tell you that most people who write books do not have a PhD. If they have one, they certainly tout it. They certainly, especially if it's a nonfiction book, will put that on the cover because it gives them credibility. But credibility can run both ways. If you write a book on a specific subject and you do a good research job, or you have somebody help you with the researching, and you write an excellent book on it, then that can give you credibility. So a lot of professionals now, psychologists, doctors, plastic surgeons, are either writing books or having books ghostwritten so that they have a book under their name, which gives them more credibility than if they didn't have a book. So it goes both ways. Once you've written a book, that gives you more credibility. It's almost as good as a PhD, or as good as a PhD in a different way.
Yes, what I'm trying to get to is the link between storytelling and passion and organization and Malcolm Gladwell's success. I mean, he has written a book that is sold in the hundreds of thousands, if not more.
And it included an original idea too. You know, it was something new out there that most people had not heard of, that particular concept of blink.
Right.
So,
but he doesn't have a PhD in psychology.
No, and he didn't have to have.
Right, because he had what? Tell me what he had that replaced his PhD in neuropsychology, not only just psychology, but neuropsychology.
Well, you know, I don't know too much about his background, but I suspect that he had already done a lot of writing about similar subjects with research, or maybe not. Maybe he took it up brand new, but he found something, some kind of a spark, probably. I mean, I wasn't there, but he probably found some kind of a spark that interested him enough to delve into it. Research is absolutely valid. That's what we do when we're starting to do a PhD. We do our research, and we take notes, and we footnote, and we learn how to do it without plagiarizing, and still use other people's ideas. You know, ideas can't be copyrighted. There was recently a suit in London against Dan Brown. Someone said that he'd used their idea in his book, and they lost. And the reason for that is that you can't copyright ideas. If you could copyright ideas, Shakespeare would be our greatest plagiarizer, and we wouldn't have anything like science fiction. If we could copyright ideas, we wouldn't be able to use all those wonderful scientific ideas to write science fiction.
And it's story. I mean, what I was getting at was the style and the presentation.
Yes.
And Malcolm, I guess he uses researchers, I mean, which is irrelevant. But the point is, Malcolm Gladwell was the captain of the ship, and that he knew when to turn left and when to turn right. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to. And when I or anyone else went to the bookstore, I didn't ask myself, well, is he qualified to write this?
Yeah, exactly.
I opened the back cover. I mean, I liked the front cover. Then I looked to the back cover. And then I opened it at random and couldn't stop reading. And I figured this is a good sign. So it is the style and the presentation that I think is the thing. Because how many books written by PhDs in psychology sell over 5,000 copies?
Oh, exactly. So it's that storytelling. And it's that voice that we were talking about. But we almost all have a voice. We use it when we talk. We use it when we coach. We use it when we discipline our children. Our voices change. We use it when we praise our children. Our voices change. We know what voice is. But then when we sit in front of a typewriter or a computer, we lose it. We think we've got to write like an automaton. But we've got it there. And the trick is to tap that voice. And he has tapped that. He tapped that a long time ago, or his work wouldn't have been in the New Yorker, because they use the best and only the best. And one of the ways we do that is by reading and by absorbing, letting what we read, when we read really good material, just sink into our souls. And then it comes back out when we're writing. It's there. And it shows. You know, metaphor, symbol. I once took a class in novel writing at UCLA, and my teacher said we have a writer's brain. Let that writer's brain talk. Let it do its thing. Let that inspiration come out on paper. And that's one reason that we're all angry with our fourth grade teachers, is that they stifled that in favor of good spelling. And so when I'm teaching writing, I tell people, don't even think about grammar. Don't even think about spelling. Just get that voice out. Get that story out. Put it on paper. Say what you need to say. Then go back. And Stephen King says the same thing in his book called, very simply, On Writing.
Mm-hmm.
Just get it all out. Put it all on paper. Then go back and edit.
Yeah, that is a wonderful book, by the way, for anyone. If they haven't read it yet, you don't have to be a Stephen King fan to read Stephen King.
No, not at all.
Book.
No, you'd never.
Well, thank you. Excuse me.
Sure.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Not at all.
Well, let's talk about this whole idea of putting your best foot forward. I'm sorry, I fell into it. Your best book forward.
In the well, that's why I did that. I'm glad you
right,
noticed.
Of course. That's wonderful. And could you expand on this, avoid humiliation and ensure success, as it per your frugal editor pertains to the planning process? How does editing fit into this pre-contract, starting to finish the manuscript process?
Let me talk just a little bit about the subtitle of that book. At first, it was just put your best book forward. Then I decided to continue with that frugal branding you were talking about. But then I wanted to use best book forward instead of best foot forward, because I thought it was so darn good. So I had best book forward to ensure success. And I passed that by a couple of trusted friends, one of them being Tim Beat, who is the director of the Irma Bombeck Writers Conference. And he's written a couple of great books. He's a humorist. And he's written a couple of great books about pirates. And I think one of his books is called In the Beginning There Were No Diapers. Very cute book. He said, "Oh no, you've got to mention in terms of editing how humiliating it is if you go unedited." And I thought, well, you know, that's a little strong. I realized that there's two ways to sell a book. You remember when you said that you turned the book over and read on the back? Well, you've got two chances to sell your book. Well, actually three, but two major chances: the front cover and the back cover. And you need to be able to sell it, and subtitles are one of the ways that you do that. And the two best ways are to show benefits for reading the book, and the other way is to scare the bejeebies out of somebody of what will happen if they don't read the book. Well, humiliation is scaring the bejeebies out of people, but you see how much stronger it is than to say it, that it will ensure success. So I debated a bit about that, and I decided to go with it, and I think it was probably one of the best things I did with that title.
Oh, what you've done there is hit if nonfiction books are purchased to either avoid a problem taking place or to achieve a goal, you've covered both bases.
Exactly.
No, really. I mean,
and I knew that. But sometimes you need input from a friend who's not only a good friend and will tell you the truth, but also a friend with some expertise. That's one reason we have coaches. There's a difference between the man on the street friend and somebody with some expertise. Well, Tim's a friend with some expertise, so I listened to him a lot more carefully than I would have if it had been, my aunt who loves my writing and just says everything I do is great. That's not helping me very much, you know.
Mm.
So that's how that title came about. And where were we? What was I supposed to be answering?
Oh, no, that's the scare of the big Jesus. I just wrote that down. I like that. That's fun. What happens to an author's future if there is a humiliating mistake in a query letter sent to an agent?
Their manuscript doesn't get read. Agents and publishers who will let manuscripts come in over the transom, which for those newbie people who are just interested in writing, means just that you send the manuscript in or a few chapters of the manuscript, and you don't need an agent to present it for you. They get a lot of query letters, a lot of proposals every single day. And although they really want to fall in love with your work, they really want to find something that will be profitable for them, they've gotten a bit jaded for the most part. They read the query letter, and if the query letter shows immediately that people can't write, and they're going to just deep six the manuscript. They don't even go on. You never get a chance to show them what a brilliant first chapter you've written. So that query letter is really, really important. And for a nonfiction book, it's a query letter and a proposal. We don't write a full nonfiction book and present it to a publisher. We write a query letter and a proposal, and that's what goes to the publisher. And then if the publisher loves it, then they will say, write the book. And a lot of people don't realize that. And to that end, I've written the Great First Impression Book Proposal. It's an Amazon short. A lot of people don't realize that Amazon is a publisher. And it's done in just 10 pages. It'll take you 20 minutes to read it. And it'll only cost you 49 cents. You get it on Amazon. And it teaches you how to use that beautiful voice we've been talking about in a book proposal to capture the interest of a publisher and let them know that about that book that's inside of you. And that's what you present to them, that query letter and that book proposal.
Oh. I do want to have you, before the end of the call, tell us a bit more how we can locate that. Sounds like an excellent use of 49 cents at minimum.
Yeah.
But secondly, I think what is the role of editing in email? Because more and more first meetings seem to take place with email rather than a snail mail. So are
sure.
we inadvertently under-editing our first impressions with people, with agents and other people we want to deal with?
I think we probably are. There's two different kinds of emails. There's casual email. I get 400 emails a day and try to answer every single one. And the casual things, they can be casual. You can use your little happy faces. In fact, probably it will help avoid some misunderstandings if you do. You can use your multiple exclamation points. You can have some fun with them. I don't think people are going to get up in arms. I don't think people should get up in arms if there's a typo or a misspelled word in those emails. It's almost like a new kind of writing. And I think writers should be patient with other writers in terms of casual writings and in terms of an occasional typo. But when we get into something like a media release sent by email or a query letter sent by email, that's a whole different thing. And most of us who have been around the publishing block a couple times, at least, do have editors or fellow writers doing some editing for us on our manuscripts. But what we forget is that query letter, that media release, is the first impression you are going to make on whoever you're contacting. And obviously you're contacting them to ask them for something. You're contacting an editor to ask them for a feature story. You're contacting an editor to ask them if they'd be interested in publishing your book. You're contacting an agent. It goes on and on. These are what I call the gatekeepers in The Frugal Editor. And they are in charge of your career. They have the power to say yes or no. Yes or no. It's in their power. So that first impression is really important. So you need to be pretty careful. You need to be really careful with that.
Especially, people tend to, and I know that you addressed this in The Frugal Editor, to trust our software to catch mistakes and especially the obvious typos. However, many word processing programs, like many blog programs, they do not spell check the subject line or the title.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So if you make a mistake in the body, like an AOL, if you make this mistake in the body, you get the underlined mistake, but not in the subject line. And yet, if I get an email with a mistake in the subject line, I don't know the person who sent it, it's history.
Well, you assume it's spam. For
yes.
One thing, you assume it's come out of Nigeria or something. And you know, I've done it. I admit it. I've done it. It's just so easy to do. You put that subject line in on a newsletter or something the very last minute. It's late at night. You're getting it out at 10:30. You know, and you that enter button goes in, and that newsletter is out there. It's the nature of the beast. And as I say, I think we should be a little bit patient with one another that way. But having said that, if it's a query letter or a media release, let it lie for a day or two and go back and look at it. And if you can't do that, print it out and give it to a neighbor to read, or your husband, or what, you know, have somebody go over it. Because even those little squiggles that Word Program or AOL does for us, they are so inadequate. Those misspellings aren't the only things that can be wrong. If you have the word in twice, your Word Program will tell you that, but I don't think AOL tells you that. Every time you edit, every time you make a little change, you set yourself up for more little errors.
Mm.
And those little errors often are words that don't get squiggles, little words that are left over like and in and X, they won't get a squiggle. So you get all those little errors, and I address that in The Frugal Editor too. But basically, it's just not getting impatient and putting things out too fast. If you give yourself some time, you can probably spot those errors. It's like reading somebody else's work if you've given yourself some space. But most of us don't do that. We're too busy, and we're multitasking. That's the other thing. We're doing six things at once and think that somehow we should be able to send out a really polished media release, you know, when we've been changing our child's diaper while we write the media release. So,
yeah.
You know, it's impossible to do it. You've just got to concentrate and give yourself some time.
During the writing phase, how much self-editing should an author do while writing the first draft?
I don't think any.
Okay.
I think you should just let that creative spirit flow and then worry about it. This is the place, my first novel. I probably rewrote that first chapter 12, 13 times. And it didn't even end up being the first chapter after I learned more about novel writing. So you can waste a whole lot of time rewriting something that you're not even going to use. I love Stephen King's advice. Just get that book out there. Now, does that mean you shouldn't outline? No, it doesn't mean that. We all work differently. Some people outline novels. Most people outline nonfiction books. But however you write, I don't outline my nonfiction books. But however you write, you should get it out there first. It'll become really apparent to you. Get it out there. Let it sit in your drawer for at least a week. Then go back. And, I mean, we have the wonder of copy and paste available to us now. So you can switch things around, pick something up from one place and say, oh, no, this goes in this section. Oh, no, this goes in that section. It's so easy. So why do we want to interrupt that inspiration and that train of thought? It's like letting your husband interrupt your writing time. You don't want to do that. You don't want people coming in and saying, about that problem we had yesterday with the dog, you know? You want to close that door and let your brain flow. As soon as somebody comes in and talks about what you're going to have for dinner that night, you are not going to remember that next sentence. And that next sentence was undoubtedly the most brilliant sentence of your writing career. You know, you had it in your mind and it's gone. So let it hang out there. Let it, you know, do it. Besides that, if you get through with a book, think of what you've accomplished. But if you keep rewriting the first chapter, you're never going to get through that book.
What have you accomplished?
You know, I've accomplished so much.
No, I mean, not you. I mean, I know what you've accomplished, but
I think it's important. I think you bring up a really important point. I think that we really need to look at what we've done. It's like writing a resume. It makes you realize how much you've done. And too many writers don't give themselves any credit. And I'm really proud that I can say, maybe it's more apparent for me because I started back to it late and I can actually measure it. I can say, I started in 1998 and look what I've done. I've got, you know, 5 books and an Amazon short. And, you know, I can enumerate that pretty easily, and it might not have been that easy if I'd been doing it for my whole life. I don't know. But I'm doing stuff that I never expected to do, and I think it's important for people to write down goals and say, I achieved this, and give myself a pat on the back and take myself out to dinner for it or whatever, and actually think about that. And what you have accomplished is something that there's a lot of people out there who dream of a book, who say they've got a book in them. There's a lot of books that people have written that are lying fallow in drawers. So if you've written a book, you've done so much. And even if it's lying in the drawer and doing nothing, you've done so much more than so many other people who have that book inside them and haven't done it. And if you've taken that book out of the drawer and it isn't lying fallow anymore and you're submitting it, that's another huge step. And if you decide after you've submitted it and it hasn't gotten published that you want to self-publish it, that's fantastic. You're going to have a book in your hands. Many people have that dream and never realize it. So that's a huge step.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. That first time that book's in your hand, wow, what an upper. But, you know, then we tend to kind of start grumbling and say, oh, well, it isn't selling well enough, or, oh, you know, or that isn't enough. Now I need, you know. No. You have control over your own career now. We have the net. We have that wonderful tool. to help people get the word out. We can't all write books that sell as well as Blink. That may or may not happen, but we can all write one that sells, and we can all have one out there that people read. And the trick is to taking control over our own writing careers and just doing it. You know, well, Nike says, just do it.
They certainly do that part well. Well, before we wrap up, I'd like to open the lines to people who might have questions, Mark or Ben.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Listen, one of the things that a question that's worked for me is I have a great deal of history of writing technical papers, and so anything I produce from a keyboard becomes very much professionally stilted.
Mm-hmm.
But I, this last year, purchased a dictation system, Dragon Naturally Speaking.
Oh, yeah.
It has completely transformed my writing.
Oh, I was going to say, how did that work for you? That's good to know.
Yeah, and I'm sort of a storyteller by nature, and so I've always had friends saying, you ought to write a book just because I'm a good storyteller. But I could never put it on paper, and now with that, it's been working beautifully.
Fantastic. Another thing you can try is using a yellow pad of paper and a pencil. Instead of the keyboard, because you're in a pattern with the keyboard, you sit in front of the keyboard for the most part, and you know you're used to technical writing, so that's where your brain goes. But if you sit down with a pad of paper, your brain will probably go in a different direction. And if that doesn't work, write with the opposite hand that you normally write with.
Oh,
interesting idea.
So if you get into writer's block, do that. There's also a really good little-known book out there called Fear of Writing. You can find it at fearofwriting.com, and it has some wonderful writing prompts in it. And those are good ones to use that handwriting thing, just exercises to get you into the mode of storytelling.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Ben.
Thanks for telling me about the program, Ben. Neat. I'm glad it works. I have never tried one.
Well, it takes probably 3 or 4 days training.
Oh, does it? Well, if you're technical, that works for you. If you're not, then woe to you, huh?
Well, I mean, you just have to do it and see what mistakes come up and learn what you're doing.
It learns from your mistakes. I mean, after every time you correct a word that it had interpreted wrongly isn't much better. It remembers
yeah,
what
but
you
we're
meant.
Getting we're getting the idea, right?
Yeah.
By the way, I believe in making up words. I think that poetry did that for me. My book of poetry, I make up words all the time now. They're words can be creative too. So if we want to say wrongly, we can.
Okay. The other heavy Mark, did you have a comment or question?
No, he's being shy.
He's being a shy
writer.
Well, I don't think Mark's a shy writer. He sends some of the most amazingly literate emails that I've been saving. I mean,
Hello.
He illuminates. Hi, is there any other one? Another question?
Hello, can you hear me?
We've got a girl voice there.
Yes, my name is Michelle. I'm Ben's wife, and I joined the call about halfway through.
Oh.
Hi. So you actually have three.
Yeah.
I've been considering writing a book. I'm a ballet teacher. A book on ballet to be published as an e-book on the internet.
Uh huh.
Your query letter and your book proposal formats, can that be applied to internet copy? Because the people who you want to purchase your book then are your readers and buyers directly on the internet. So you're addressing, instead of addressing a publisher, you're addressing your market directly.
Well, that's not really true because there are e-book publishers.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And having said that you want to publish it just as an e-book, let me just tell you a little story.
Okay.
When I first came up with the idea of the Frugal Book Promoter, I had just gone back to UCLA where I studied writing and asked to begin to teach some writing classes. And I said that I was about to publish the Frugal Book Promoter as an e-book. And my idea was I wanted to get it out fast. And I thought because it was such a small, a narrow niche, that would be sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, niche marketing is really important now, and it wouldn't have a wide enough market to be published by HarperCollins anyway, so
mm-hmm.
why not just in quotes an e-book? And the director of the department was impressed with the e-book idea, and that made it even more important that I do it as an e-book, because now I had a class to teach in the fall,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted that book out fast, and you can get an e-book out much more quickly than a paperback.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to my publisher, the publisher I decided on, I told her that I was just going to do it as an e-book. And the best thing she ever did for me, by the way, that's Star Publish, and it is a subsidy publisher. And they publish e-books and paperback. She said, oh, no, publish it as a paperback, too. So I did. And, of course, it's been off and on at the top of the Amazon charts now for nearly 4 years, and it never would have had the readership if I had just published it as an e-book. A very small percentage of readers read e-books.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean we shouldn't have them out there, our books out there as an e-book. We should, if we're good marketers, we want our book available in all possible ways, the way people want to read it. So Kindle, e-books for Sony, e-books, you know, PDF files, you know, whatever way people want to buy it, you want to make sure that it's out there in a way that they can buy it. That's good retailing. That's good marketing. But one of the ways they want to buy it, most people want to buy it, is as a book, as a real book. So
okay.
Ballet, I've done ballet. I'd be interested, but I probably wouldn't want to read it on a screen. I'd probably want to read it as a real book. So my advice to you is, if the niche that you're trying to reach is broad enough at all, do consider doing it both ways, not just as an e-book only.
So if you go through a publisher, you can also publish as an e-book?
Depends on the contract you write with them. Some publishers publish only e-books. Some publishers publish only real books. Some people do both. If you want it as an e-book, and you're dealing with a publisher who only publishes paperback, then you make sure that you make them aware that you want that contract written that way so that you're still able to do it as an e-book as well.
Okay. Is there a place where I can find more information on that?
Go to starpublishllc.com and talk to the publisher, TC.
Okay.
And she can, and I think that they're really an excellent publisher, and she can answer your questions and probably get you on the road to getting started.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Carolyn, are there any other questions you wished I had asked you?
Well, I did want to talk about that Amazon short.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon has discontinued publishing shorts for a short period. I think they're reviewing their concept, but it's a wonderful way to publish a short work as opposed to a longer work. And originally when they published, you know how I always think sometimes we get our minds closed, we think we can't do something or we don't want to do something. A lot of my friends were publishing short stories as Amazon shorts, and I really wasn't interested in doing that. But when I started working with a client, he's a doctor at USC, and he has a wonderful book on meditation coming out. He didn't want to learn how to write a proposal. And I kept saying, well, you know, your proposal is where it's at for this nonfiction book. And I recommended a couple of good books. There are a couple of them out there for book proposals. He didn't want to read it. He didn't want to go to that trouble. He didn't want to learn how to write a proposal because he figured he was one of those people who wasn't really a writer. He's a doctor. So he was going to have to go to enough trouble just learning to write the book. He didn't want to learn to write a book proposal, too. And they are different skills again. So he was willing to hire me, and I'm you know, not cheap to write the book proposal. And I thought, this is perfect for an Amazon short because I can teach people to write a book proposal. It doesn't take a whole book to do it. It only takes them 20 minutes, and it's a very, very cheap way to learn for 49 cents. So that's what I did, and I think it's really valuable. It's almost like a little gift from me to writers. Furthermore, a lot of fiction publishers are now asking for book proposals, especially if you're writing genre fiction like romances and you plan a serial or a series of books. They're asking for book proposals as opposed to full books. So it's becoming more and more accepted instead of less and less accepted in the publishing industry. So it won't hurt to learn to write one.
And if when someone buys the Amazon short, do you receive a? How do you know who bought it?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. And that's probably true of most books, unless you've completely self-published and you're mailing your own books out of your garage. You almost never know who's buying your books. The nice thing about Amazon is they track who's buying your books, and then when your next book comes out, they actually use that list to help publicize or market your next book out. They're very good at that way. So Amazon's a great promotion powerhouse, and it's good to have them on your team.
But were you given complete freedom for what appeared on each page?
The only way you get complete freedom for what's appearing on each page is if you're completely self-publishing. That means by self-publishing, I'm using it in its narrowest context. Mm-hmm. That means that you write the book, you get your own editor, you get your own ISBN number, you get your own formatter, you get your own book cover designer, you put everything find your own press to print it on, you do everything yourself. That's the only way you have complete control. If you have somebody else do it, they make suggestions. But Amazon was, by the time I did that, I was pretty up on publishing and kind of knew what to expect. So they did publish it pretty much the way I wanted it to be published. They did a nice cover for me.
Were you able to refer to your URL in the book?
Yes.
That's
actually one of the reasons for the shorts, I'm sure. One of the things that they have in mind is they're really trying to push or let readers know inexpensively about other things on the on their site that people can buy.
Right. Okay, well,
an e-book. Exactly. It's like an e-book, and you use those links.
Well, I would love to have a follow-up call at some point when you have time to do it.
Oh, I'd love to do it.
Because I think that is an incredibly important tool. Are there any questions? You have so many resources, so many things at your website. Could you close by just reviewing where we should go and if people who are accessing these recordings want to contact you or learn more, where should they go?
Okay. My website is howtodoitfrugally.com. Two L's in frugally. And I blog at sharingwithwriters.blogspot.com. And you can get all my books on Amazon or bondsandnoble.com. And I think that's probably the most essential. My email is hojonews@aol.com, and I welcome emails. Just be really clear in your subject line so that I don't think it's spam. Mention
Hojo. Could you HOJONEWS at AOL?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Carolyn,
I mentioned this program, so I know that it's not spam.
I'm thinking. Okay. May I ask a question, please?
Hi, Michelle.
This is Paulette.
Oh, I'm sorry, Carla.
No problem. I'm on Amazon.com's website, and I'm looking for Amazon Short, but I don't see it.
On the search engine, just punch in my name, Carolyn Howard Johnson, with a dash between the Howard and the Johnson,
okay.
And all my books will come up on that page for you.
Okay.
And including the short.
Okay. And how does one find out if one is interested in doing the same thing? How does one
go about doing the short?
Yes.
They've closed submissions for the short for right now.
I see.
But there is a menu on the left-hand side of the home page of Amazon. And I think it's under services.
I see features and services. I'm seeing that now.
That's probably where it is. And they might have removed it for the time being until they decide where they're going with that program.
Okay. I don't see it, so I understand what you're saying.
So you just have to watch for that then for when they bring it back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I think one of the problems that they had is that they can't sell Amazon shorts to Canadians or for overseas because it's so cheap that I think they end up losing money because the dollar is so weak and the euro is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the reasons that they've had to pull back and rethink what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that it will probably come back modified in some way.
I think it will because I think it's been very, very valuable for them. I think it was a really excellent program.
Well, Carolyn, thank you for. I just feel so wonderful about this call. I feel like I've made a friend, and actually several.
Absolutely,
friends.
We have made friends.
I look forward to talking to you and learning more from your website. There certainly are a lot of resources there on your site, and thank you for your time and being so gracious with your information. This is Roger Parker for Published and Profitable, the 4 Steps to Success, where you learn to plan, write, promote, and profit from a book. And thank you again, and thank you, everyone. Bye now.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye.
Bye-bye.